Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
It was the last chance the government had left to shift the political dial before the general election. But has this week's budget succeeded in helping the Tories and harming Labour? Welcome to Political Fix, your essential insider guide to Westminster, from the Financial Times with me, Lucy Fisher. Coming up, was Chancellor Jeremy Hunt a tax-cutting wizard this week, or a fiscal drag queen, as our own sketchwriter dubbed him? With me in the studio are Sumaya Keynes, the FT's economics columnist. Hi, Sumaya.
Hello.
Plus our Political Fix regulars, George Parker. Hi, George.
Hi, Lucy.
And Stephen Bush. Hi, Stephen.
Hi, Lucy.
Just what is the economic story the Conservatives sought to paint for voters with this week's budget? Just a recap on the Chancellor's version.
It is to unleash people power that we today put this country back on the path to lower taxes. A plan to grow the economy versus no plan. A plan for better public services versus no plan. A plan to make work pay versus no plan. Growth up, jobs up. Taxes down. I commend this statement to the House.
Well, Labour's Sir Keir Starmer said the Chancellor was delusional.
The Chancellor, who breezes into this chamber in a recession and tells the working people of this country that everything's on track. Crisis? What crisis?
Well, that was Keir Starmer's verdict. I want to ask each of you first what you made of it, your snap verdict. Sumaya.
I would say that he met very, very low expectations.
Ooh, quite frosty. George?
Well, I think I'll leave it to the words of one of his many predecessors as Tory Chancellor, who said it was distinctly underwhelming.
Stephen?
I think considering the circumstances, considering where the part of the party wanted him to go, it was about as good a budget as it would be possible to deliver at this point.
Generous. Well, I want to get into the detail of the measures that were in the budget. But before we do that, Sumaya, take us through the economic picture that Jeremy Hunt sketched out. Was it significantly worse than what we heard from him in the autumn statement?
Not very much, to be honest. I mean, really thinking about the economic outlook, it's pretty similar to what we had back in the autumn. I think the outlook for interest rates, inflation has slightly improved. If we think about households and what the Office of Budget Responsibility is projecting that people are going to feel, that looks a bit better than what we saw in the autumn. But in terms of the kind of conditions for the public finances, they're pretty much where they were back in the autumn. The change is because of the decisions that Hunt took in terms of tax cuts that will tend to increase borrowing.
George, take us through the main measures, and in particular, the winners and losers quickly.
Well, I mean, most of this was pre-briefed in advance. So one of the surprising things about the budget was how few surprises there were. So at the core of it was this, you know, if you look through the red book, the score book, the national insurance cut of 2p was by far the biggest thing in the budget. It cost about £10 billion. It reduces the rate of national insurance from 10p to 8p, and that mirrors the similar cuts or identical cuts in the autumn statement. The one minor surprise in the budget, and it will be welcomed by many, many middle-income families, is the review of this notorious cliff edge in the tax system where your child benefit begins to be removed once one earner in the household hits the £50,000 salary cap. And the tax cuts there were funded by a number of targeted tax rises, or partly funded by a number of tax rises. On, for example, people who smoke vapes will be paying a bit more. Oil and gas companies will have a windfall tax extended. If you travel business class in planes, your air passenger duty will go up. So a number of targeted tax rises. So it wasn't like the autumn statement where there were over 100 separate measures. This was actually very targeted, and all the real fiscal firepower, and as Sumaya said, there wasn't very much of that, was focused on that big national insurance tax cut.
And Stephen, there'd been a lot of talk beforehand, before the budget, about whether Hunt would go for national insurance or going for that income tax cut that many Tory MPs felt would be a little easier to explain to the electorate, perhaps politically more popular. What did you make of his decision not to go for that?
It summed up the balance between the Chancellor Jeremy Hunt would perhaps like to be, perhaps more responsible, not using all of his headroom in a probably doomed bid to turn around the electoral fortunes of the Conservative Party, and the demands of large parts of his party to go much further to, you know, essentially deliver the trust budget a second time and hope for a better result. And I thought, considering that pressure, it was the most sensible lever to pull. The thing lots of Treasury wonks will tell you is, and the other joy of using national insurance is because it's a more popular tax than income tax, given the extreme likelihood that whoever wins the next election will have to claw at least some of this back, it's probably the easier one of the two taxes to find a way of going, I know I said I was cutting it, but what I actually meant was you now pay a Stop Putin levy or a Save Our NHS levy or whatever thing that will look a lot like national insurance to claw it back with. So I thought it did the best possible job of meeting the internal party pressure, the limits and his fiscal rules impose on him, and at the same time being able to, you know, get out of the box that he's made for himself and all made for Rachel Reeves.
Samir, I mean, one of the big announcements that Hunt at least hinted at was this idea that the Conservatives, if they get back into power again, could potentially abolish NI altogether. We've heard Rishi Sunak also come out and talk about the scourge of double taxation, how it's unfair for workers. What's your appraisal of that idea of getting rid of it?
Oh, there was this beautiful moment in the budget speech where I thought he was going to announce merging them then and there. And I swiveled on my chair to look at my colleague Chris Giles in anticipation. And then he disappointed me.
So just to check, that would have been a good thing in your...
That would have been a great thing, right? Okay. I mean, you know, simplifying the tax schedule, I'm a good nerdy economist. Complexity is nasty. Simplicity is good. At the moment, what we have in the tax schedule is this kind of wedge between how much we tax employment and how much we tax self-employment. Employer national insurance contributions basically make it more expensive to get someone to do something as an employee than it is to hire them as a contractor. That is ugly. It creates distortions. I don't like that. A world in which we could have the simpler system without that kind of wedge is a better one, in my view.
Okay, George, so it floats the boat of the nerdy economists. Mm. But politically, I mean, are there any votes in this? I mean, what do you make of it?
Well, the thing about national insurance, and Stephen was alluding to this, it's a tax which the voters don't really understand that well. That's one of the reasons why the Treasury likes putting it up, because people don't quite understand what it is. Equally, cutting it has the reverse effect, that people don't really understand what exactly it is being cut. So lots of Tory MPs said beforehand, we want this to be an income tax cut. It's something you can put on the front page of the Daily Mail, something people understand. You can put it on your leaflets when you're out campaigning. National insurance reductions are a harder thing to explain. I agree with Stephen and Samir that actually, if you're going to cut taxes, it's actually economically a more sensible thing to do because it's targeted on workers. So I think a lot of Tory MPs were concerned that they'd gone for this again. And then there was this curious thing, this idea that he announces this 2p cut on, in addition to the 2p cut in November, so 4p cut, that's £900 in total for the average worker. You would think that that would be the message of the budget, instead of which, a day later, we're talking about this idea of scrapping national insurance altogether. And Labour Party, I think, has quite rightly pointed out, well, hang on a sec, you can't just go around saying we're going to do this and not explain how you're going to do it. Labour thinks it will cost £46 billion. And Tories say, well, it's just a long-term ambition, doesn't really matter, who cares, you know, blah, blah, blah. But can you imagine if a Labour politician went into a radio studio and said, my ambition is to spend nearly £50 billion on the NHS and not expect to be asked a few questions about exactly how it's going to be paid for?
Can I just jump in and clarify that I am very much in favour of the two being merged? I'm not necessarily in favour of just cutting national insurance to zero without doing anything else to offset it, right? That's my dream, is the merging, not the cutting of the average of the two.
Got it. And while I'm with you, why had all the measures been pre-trailed quite so extensively? I mean, often there are kites flown ahead of a budget. Sometimes that's to see how the market responds to certain ideas that are then ultimately shelved. But on Wednesday, there were no rabbits left in the hat, and it left some newspaper editors clearly pretty miffed. We saw the front page of City AM, you know, rabbit missing.
Is there a reason for that? Is it in the wake of the disastrous 2022 mini budget of Liz Truss and Kwasi Kwarteng that Jeremy Hunt feels he has to do extra pitch rolling of all the measures to get the markets ready?
I'm a little bit sceptical of that theory. I think we're well beyond the era of Truss. I mean, there is a sort of strategy in pre-announcing the thing that you know that all of the wonks are going to kind of howl at, right? So everyone, by the time the budget day came along, everyone was just exhausted and said, oh, fine, you know what, just do it. It's not the right thing to do. You don't need to do a tax cut. This is not appropriate for the fiscal position, but you're going to do it. Oh, fine. And so there could be some logic in that. I mean, I was pleasantly surprised by some things in there. I thought the funding for new NHS IT systems was nice, if it happens, which is a fairly big caveat. I mean, I think the people who should probably be most miffed at the lack of the rabbit were Parliament, who last time I checked was supposed to hear of any tax changes first. So that feels to me like the more kind of controversial thing that happened here.
Yeah, and there are a few MPs who commented to me that, you know, Lindsay Hoyle would not be in a position, as he usually is, perhaps, to really slap wrists on this front, given the recent hot water he's found himself in. Stephen, let's look at where the budget leaves Labour. For a start, Keir Starmer said in his response that this was the last act of a desperate, failed government. And yet, there's nothing in the budget that Labour is actually going to oppose or reverse if it gets into power.
This was the bit of the budget that was politically astute, right? In that Labour started this week with three main revenue raises, the stuff which funds all of their retail offers and goodies, the energy company levy, reforming the non-dom regime and VAT on private schools. And they end the week with two of those having been snaffled by Jeremy Hunt. It does put Labour in this very tricky position because they need to find some way that they can say, yes, we'd do things differently without ending up in that familiar death zone for Labour campaigns, which is anxieties about the idea that they'd put tax up too much on ordinary people.
And they are going to have to raise taxes, right? Because they've committed to continuing with funding extra NHS appointments and the school breakfast clubs, which is what the non-dom scrapping was supposed to do before Hunt nicked that policy for them.
Yeah, exactly. And I have to confess, I can't remember what they were going to do with their extension of the windfall tax on energy.
Well, they
on
were,
the energy
like
offers,
the but government going to do extend it for a year. I think they're also going to raise the rate from 35 to 38%. But they're still insisting that they're also going to close a lot of loopholes. Mm. So they claim there's still some revenue to be had from that.
And of course, the other thing that is happening is, as we speak, the Labour Party is wrangling over the contents of its manifesto. In addition to the fact we anticipate they will want some new goodies, so we write about them as new rather than going, oh yeah, breakfast clubs, yeah, we've heard this all before. Presumably, various influential cabinet, shadow cabinet ministers will be going, well, I need to have my money for X, right? I would be very surprised, for example, if at the end of the manifesto process, Yvette Cooper does not have something she can point to on police numbers. And so that all puts further pressure on the Shadow Treasury team because they are going to have to find some tax that is not going to be attacked by wonks for creating additional problems, that is not going to be unpopular in Middle England, and can plausibly fund the stuff they want to do without, you know, opening up those fears people have about Labour.
One thing we shouldn't lose sight of here is the fact that for the second big fiscal event in a row, the Labour Party has basically gone along with the whole thing. That's an extraordinary thing, isn't it? They're the opposition party, after all. And you had two statements, the autumn statement of the budget, where the Labour Party, as far as I can tell, hasn't opposed a single measure. Now, you could say that's because Jeremy Hunt's nicking Labour policies, or you could say the Labour Party is becoming a bit more Tory. The real answer, of course, is what they're trying to do is close down any exposed weaknesses or flanks in their position from Tory attacks. But it's still a ruthless, if somewhat cynical, approach, I think, for an opposition party to take.
I think that's a really interesting point, George. Don't you think it leaves them slightly vulnerable to the attack that the two main parties are all the same? Mm. An attack we can expect to be made by the SNP, by the Green Party, by the Lib Dems, and by the likes of Momentum, the sort of left-wing campaigners within the Labour movement.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, from the SNP's point of view, it's an absolute godsend. So incidentally, is the government extended the windfall tax on oil and gas companies in Scotland. But that's a separate thing. I mean, yes, they will be attacked from the left and by the SNP. But I suspect, you know, being accused of being a bit too much like the Tories on the economy, notwithstanding the slightly checkered record on the economy the Tories have had recently, but nevertheless, being a bit too Tory on the economy is probably not a bad place for the Labour Party to be ahead of an election.
So, Mayor, looking ahead to the period after the election, talk to us a bit about the inheritance whoever wins power will have regarding public spending.
Yeah, I don't think that Jeremy Hunt delivered a budget that he would be happy to inherit himself after the next election. So if you look at the public finances, what's happened is that he's announced these tax cuts, and in order to kind of meet his own fiscal rules, we can have a separate discussion about those, but essentially what he's done is pencil in a settlement for public services that is extremely tight for unprotected departments. So the NHS will get real terms increases, of course, it always does, but the unprotected departments, prisons, local government, they will see real terms cuts of an order of magnitude that we saw under the coalition austerity period. That is going to be extremely difficult. And, you know, just thinking about the economic outlook, perhaps you can hope that AI is going to revolutionize everything. Maybe the UK will solve its productivity problems. Maybe economic inactivity will suddenly start falling. We can dream, I certainly do. But I wouldn't envy the next chancellor having to deal with things if that doesn't all happen.
Stephen, what's your reaction you've picked up from Tory MPs to all this, and in particular for the timing of the next general election? What does it tell us, this budget?
I would say the Conservative response has mostly been pretty lukewarm, right? I think that, it feels that the Labour Party really wants this idea that it might be in May to sort of become the new talking point in Westminster, but I am...
Are they trying a bit too hard, I wonder?
They seem to be getting surprisingly good coverage. I mean, you know, John Ashworth managed to get 2 days on saying he's bet £10 on whether or not it'd be an election in May. I mean, I think it's pretty obvious that they don't really believe it and they're trying to sort of spook the horses. But you know, good luck to them, I guess.
But there's a curious interview, wasn't there, that Jeremy Vine from BBC Radio 2 was doing with the Prime Minister, where he asked about whether the Prime Minister would like to exclude a May election. And the Prime Minister declined to use the words he's used in the past, which was, my working assumption is there'll be an election in the second half of the Parliament. So you get that whole thing going again. You wonder what he's up to there, because surely the answer to that question is just to repeat your old formula. As long as you leave open the possibility of a May election, you leave open the opportunity for the Labour Party to say, ha-ha, he's running scared.
What was your take on the interview? Was he meaning to give that impression, or is he just bad at politics?
I think I spoke to someone down in the coffee queue in Portcullis House at Westminster who said exactly that. He's just bad at politics. Because actually, you know, even if you are thinking about that it's a good idea to have an election when you're 20 points behind in the opinion polls and the country's in a recession, you don't basically advertise it. You spring it as a surprise and look bold and confident. You don't let it hang out there. You want to keep your opponents guessing a bit.
So that means we're likely to have another fiscal statement before the general election. Samir, what could we see in that? I mean, how much kind of headroom could there potentially be for more tax cuts, a big pre-election giveaway offer?
Well, obviously, it depends on how the economy progresses, right? I mean, if interest rates go the wrong way, then gambling everything on another set of forecasts from the Office for Budget Responsibility looks quite risky, right? What you don't want is to say, sure, let's do another fiscal event. The OBR come out with terrible public finances forecasts, and then you have to raise taxes going into an election. That's bad vibes, I think.
To put it mildly.
even as a non-political expert, I would suggest. So yeah, I mean, it depends on the outlook for interest rates, inflation, those trends in the labour market. You know, has this problem with inactivity changed at all? What's going on with immigration? Obviously, if it all goes the right way, then they might be rubbing their hands with glee and saying, yeah, bring it on. We want to deliver another tax cut, which we can announce with made-up spending figures that will make them look okay. And then, again, the next government will have to pick up the pieces.
Stephen?
Well, because the thing is, they did two very interesting things in this fiscal event. The first was the one bit of briefing which didn't make it into the final document was this idea of, oh, what if we, instead of having a 1% rise, we have a 0.75% one?
In public spending.
In public spending, right? Which, because of the way their fiscal rule works, they can essentially go like, oh, don't worry, it adds up, because at the end of the forecast, I'll remake the relationship between the citizen and the state, which is unlikely to happen. So they have still got the option to do more things like that. But also the other thing that I think is worth noting is the next comprehensive spending review is now definitely scheduled for after the election, regardless of when it is. which does mean that this final fiscal event becomes less risky because the freedom to do more stupid things and make more silly claims is larger than it ideally should be.
But, George, there are a few nasties looming, aren't there, that have been purposefully pushed beyond the budget. Yeah. Compensation for Horizon, there's the infected blood scandal. You know, there's some big liabilities coming down the line.
Yeah, exactly. And it's one of the reasons why Jeremy Hunt made absolutely clear to everyone in the Treasury that this was it. This was the final fiscal event, or at least people should treat it as if it was the final fiscal event before an election. But as Soumaya says, you would only have a second budget type event in the autumn if you absolutely rock solid that, notwithstanding the infected blood compensation scheme, which could cost over £10 billion, plus the Horizon Post Office compensation scheme, only then, you're absolutely certain you've got to have some more money to play with, would you do it? And even in those circumstances, delivering tax cuts on the eve of an election, the public, this is the oldest trick in the game. Everyone can see through it. It's a pre-election bribe, people will think. And they'll probably also think that immediately after the election, whoever wins is going to put the taxes back up again.
It's worth just really underlining this point that the OBR forecasts are uncertain, right? I mean, you will have experienced the whiplash in the briefing over the past few weeks. It's like, oh, we got a good one, we've got some headroom. Oh dear, no, we've got another bad one, right? You go through rounds of these forecasts. They can be wildly different. Arguably, Jeremy Hunt was lucky with this set of forecasts that the window closed exactly when it did. It could have gone worse. And so it really is a gamble, right? Even if inflation interest rates did a particular thing, it might be quite hard to predict what exactly the OBR would say.
You make me think of the criticism we often hear from those on the Tory right saying, why should the OBR be so powerful given its forecasts are often wrong and they're so changeable? Do you think there's something in that, that there's too much power that the Office for Budget Responsibility, the fiscal watchdog, has?
I think that it's really a function of the government's policy rather than the OBR itself. I mean, essentially, the government is being marked on the difference between two very large numbers in 5 years' time, right? That is a very hard thing to predict.
Remind us, the numbers are
taxes and spending. it is hard to predict where the economy is going to be in 5 years' time. Very small tweaks in your assumptions can have huge effects on those numbers, which is why they tend to swing around over successive iterations. I think, again, we can have a whole discussion about the fiscal rules, how sensible they are. Do they constrain borrowing unnecessarily? Do they mean that you have to have people scrambling twice a year to make the numbers add up? Do they hinder sensible policymaking? Do they encourage enough investment? But the OBR is just a cog in that machine. They're not the problem, right? The thing driving this is the weird fiscal rules, which are set by the government.
And of course, the alternative to the OBR doing the forecast is the Treasury doing the forecast itself, which is, of course, what Gordon Brown used to do when he was Chancellor. And people inside the Treasury will make that point that, you know, someone's got to mark the scorecard.
I think there is an argument to be made that it's great to have the OBR, but it was a problem to completely denude the Treasury of its forecasting capacity, then we would probably be better off if you had both. But of course, that's an argument that it's very hard for a political party to make when it's just done the Truss mini budget, when it therefore has to be ostentatiously pro the watchdog, because we just saw what happens when it's not.
Well, Labour might have a little more manoeuvre room if they want to shake things up. Well, we've just got time left for stock picks. George, who are you buying or selling this week?
Well, I think I have to be selling someone unconnected to the budget. That's someone called Michel Donnellan, who's the science secretary, who's had to settle a libel case with an academic who she wrongly accused of being a supporter of Hamas. The thing about this libel settlement is that the taxpayer has had to fund a £15,000 payout, and there's a lot of pressure on Michel Donnellan to pay it out of her own pocket. But whatever the financial arrangements behind this, it's obviously called into doubt her judgment, to put it mildly.
Stephen?
I'm going to buy a concept. I'm going to buy the concept of divisions after the Chancellor has finished speaking, which the SNP forced a division, which usually doesn't happen. Usually the first vote just goes through on the nod. I was struck listening to Keir Starmer's speech afterwards that it was far and away the most unflustered delivery I have seen from a leader of the opposition in that slot. Now, of course, that's partly because the politics are flowing his way. But just from a physical performance perspective, you could tell that the extra 15 minutes of sitting there with Rachel Reeves to one side of him, Darren Jones to the other, going, you know, what about this? What about that? Had improved the quality of what they could say. And I think if I were the leader of the opposition, I would start thinking, oh, you know, actually having a division right after the Chancellor speaks is like a very, because obviously the budget is so asymmetrically geared towards the government of the day.
Yeah.
You know, then I would think, you know, actually forcing a division on this and giving the principal some time to think about it a bit more is not a bad use of parliamentary theatre. So I, it did strike me that I felt that time had clearly been pretty well used.
Well, come here for your niche takes, folks. Sumaya.
I'm going to be buying Arun Advani, who is a former colleague of mine, actually, when I used to be at the IFS many, many moons ago. So he has been doing research on the effect of reforming the non-DOMS rules, essentially arguing that this wouldn't be financial catastrophe. It wouldn't be that everyone would leave if you tightened up the tax system. And it looks like some version of the idea has been put into practice.
Who are you buying or selling, Lucy?
Well, I'm buying David Cameron because he's done a little video this week just reminding everyone he's been in just for just over 100 days. He's been to 36 visits across 26 countries. He's spoken at 8 multilateral gatherings. And I just thought, wow, for 100 days, it really has been the most remarkable reputation rehabilitation following the Greensill scandal. So I think you've got to hand it to him. And some would call it a cabinet of pygmies. I'm not saying that's my own opinion, but, you know, he clearly is a very talented communicator, and I think that's come to the fore. Well, that's all we've got time for this week. My thanks to Sumaya Keynes, Stephen Bush, George Parker. Thanks for joining.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that's it for this episode of the FT's Political Fix. I've put links to subjects discussed in this episode in the show notes. Do check them out. They're articles we've made free for Political Fix listeners. There's also a link there to Stephen's award-winning Inside Politics newsletter. You'll get 30 days free. And don't forget to subscribe to the show. Plus, do leave a review or a star rating. It really helps us spread the word. Political Fix was presented by me, Lucy Fisher, and produced by Manuela Zaragoza, with help from Leah Quinn. Original music and sound engineering by Breen Turner. Cheryl Brumley is the FT's Global Head of Audio. We'll meet again here next week.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.